Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torta. The Alaska Rock Gym was founded in 1995 by local climbers wanting a place to train, socialize, and help expand the sport. For 30 years and at two different locations, the business has provided a facility and programs that help introduce newbies to the sport, allow climbers to train, hold climbing and fitness classes, and organize climbing competitions. On this Outdoor Explorer, I host Nicole Jolin, General Manager, Siri Moss, former general manager and one of the original founders, and Bruce Adams, builder, climber, and another of the original founders. Stay tuned for Outdoor Explorer.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torta. Today, we're learning about the Alaska Rock Gym, which just celebrated its 30th anniversary in Anchorage. I have Nicole Jolin, the general manager of Alaska Rock Gym, Siri Moss, one of the original founders and former general manager, and Bruce Adams with us on Zoom. He is also original founder and helped build the original gym. Also, welcome to the show.
Thanks. We're happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Great. I'm
nice
really
to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce, for joining us. Let's start with each one of you sort of introducing yourself. Let's start with Siri. How did you get into climbing, and what's your history and role with Alaska Rock Gym?
Well, I climbed a bit in college down at University of Washington in Seattle. And when I came to Alaska and married Charlie Cicera, Charlie was a very serious climber. So, and he was very patient. I think ultimately, he just really wanted a belay partner, but he very patiently got me into climbing, and I soon fell in love with it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So we were part of, with a few other people in town, the original founders of the Alaska Rock Gym.
Thanks. And Nicole?
Tale as old as time. I moved to Colorado and started working at a summer camp teaching little kiddos how to climb. Got a membership at the Boulder Rock Club. And then started working at a climbing gym and just have been clawing my way to the top ever since in the climbing industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how long have you been with ARG?
Gosh, 15 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, welcome.
Thanks.
And Bruce, how about what's your history with climbing and the Rock Gym?
I grew up in Colorado. I started climbing when I was in high school, 17 years old, in El Dorado Canyon. I climbed for 25 years outdoors before I even touched an indoor plastic hold. But eventually I got interested in indoor climbing, and I was kind of transitioning back and forth between Colorado and Anchorage. And eventually in the 90s, a group of us just sort of started saying, hey, we need a climbing gym in Anchorage.
Nice. And we'll get into that history. Let's see, Nicole, why don't we start with you? Let's give us an overview of Alaska Rock Gym, which, and for the listeners, once in a while, we'll also refer to it as ARG. So give us a little overview, describe us the facility, the services you provide, and the programs.
Yeah, of course. The facility is a little smaller than 25,000 square feet, and 20,000 of that is dedicated to climbing areas and climbing surfaces. We've got bouldering area, so that's climbing without ropes. And we've also got roped routes up to 40 feet high. We've got a 16-foot kilter board, and so that's a little newer technology where you can adjust the angle of the board, you link it to an app in your phone, and you light up whatever climb you want to do, so it can be very beginner-friendly to very advanced. And then we've also got, at any given time, anywhere between 8 and 10 auto belays, and that really makes the access to people who don't have a belay partner much more achievable because they can just kind of go clip and climb. And then for our non-climbing related things, we've got a really great fitness and yoga studio. We offer daily yoga and fitness classes that are free with entry. We've got a really great retail shop and just really generally an upbeat, friendly vibe and atmosphere to come hang out.
And you're located where?
We're right in the heart of Anchorage in Midtown.
All right, great.
Yeah.
Conveniently not near the Massachusetts, but yeah. thank you. Let's see. I want to get into some of the history. And let's talk with maybe, I don't know, Bruce, you want to start this. What was the catalyst of forming the Alaska Rod Gym?
I think originally we all started sort of getting this idea in about 1994 as other gyms were popping up across the country. And APU, as you know, had a small climbing wall. So J.J. Brooks and I climbed there quite a bit. J.J. was my main rock climbing partner. And I was at AMH one day talking to Marcy, and I was going, yeah, JJ and I kind of want to open a gym. And she said that Peter Hackett, who is a physician in Anchorage, and Charlie Cicera, who was a mountaineer in Anchorage, had mentioned the same thing to her. I didn't know either of those people, but I managed to put a meeting together between Charlie, JJ, Peter, and myself, and we met at Charlie's house sometime in 1994, and that was kind of the start of all of it. The next big project, of course, was to find money for it and to find a location. Most gyms in those days were building walls inside of a warehouse, and so we started looking for a suitable warehouse. That's kind of how it all started.
Yeah, and for listeners, full disclosure, I was part of that original APU gym. So there was APU. I remember, wasn't there something at a gymnastics club or something
Castle
like that?
Castle Rock. Yeah.
Castle Rock,
yes.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Huh. But those had other things going on. It just wasn't solely climbing.
Correct.
Yeah, and so you found a location. Where was the location at?
The original location was 4840 Fairbank Street. And one of the problems was all the warehouses in Anchorage had basically 22-foot ceilings, mm-hmm. and we all agreed that that was not high enough. And so we finally talked the Peterson group, who owned this warehouse, into letting us lease the warehouse. And our proposal was we were going to dig out part of the warehouse to make the climbing surfaces taller by going down instead of up. So we ended up with a 30-foot clear span area to put our climbing walls in. And that was kind of a big deal. We had to tear the slab out and we had heavy equipment in there. We dug the pit out, and then we of course had to fill back in with another partial slab and redo some of the plumbing and electrical. And quite a project.
Yeah, and so for people who aren't familiar with indoor climbing, like what was it made of? Was it like I think this will be as the show goes on, we'll get into the evolution of climbing walls, but what was the original one made of?
Well, that was sort of a problem too, because nowadays there's lots of companies or several companies that build walls, but back in its infancy, there were only a few people in the country that sort of knew anything about that trade. And I was consulting with a person in Boulder named John McGowan, who owned a gym in Boulder. And he recommended a carpenter named Steve Holmes, who had framed some walls. So we got Steve Holmes on the phone. He agreed to come up for 3 months and kind of frame in the original wall. And it it basically was just 2x6 framing at different angles. And then it was sheathed with 3/4 inch plywood. And then John McGowan and his dad had a company that put the texture on, and the texture was called Dude Tex after his dad. And so they came up after the walls were framed and spent probably 5 weeks texturing 5,000 feet of climbing surface and placing little T-nuts in it so you could screw the plastic holds on and change the holds, of course. And then you needed some sort of safety padding in the floor. And again, modern gyms have got various kinds of sort of gymnastic style padding, but what was used back then was pea gravel. So we bought tons and tons and tons of pea gravel, and we put that down in the climbing area. And that was the original sort of safety feature on the floor.
Huh, yeah, I forgot about the pea gravel. And you know, for people aren't familiar with climbing, you obviously have ropes involved, and you had anchors, which are the things that hold the rope on the top, right? What kind of anchors were there?
Correct. Over the years, people have used a variety of anchors, but it's always some sort of a bolt system with heavy-duty steel carabiners or sometimes even belay bars that the ropes are looped around.
That's super interesting. So Siri, at some point, you got involved and started managing it, right?
We went into the project with a decent set of plans, but there was so much about it, we were just winging it. And I had some construction management experience, and so stepped in really dealing with permitting all the various departments. And our biggest challenge was that we were putting a wood structure in a building with no sprinkler system. And I have to say that Cleo and Dan at the Anchorage Fire Department were instrumental in helping us figure out how to do that so that we could open the business. And the phrase intumescent paint will forever bring shivers to my spine. We ended up having to coat the entire inside of the climbing surface and the back of the walls with intumescent paint, which it's not a great product to deal with, and it was a huge expense, which we weren't anticipating.
Yeah.
But we got through all of that, and we were also working with the building department on permitting as we went along. And that was what I was doing every day pretty much through the construction project.
And I bet those the Muni people didn't really know anything about this, I imagine.
No, I spent a lot of time explaining what a climbing gym
was. And so you got opened, and what were some of the challenges and rewards those first few years of managing it?
Oh, my gosh. I think the first thing was the reward of this very small Anchorage climbing community really came together to help us. And I remember the day that Bruce and I unlocked the front door, and we were kind of sitting there going, well, I guess we're open. Christian, do you remember Christian Steiner, Bruce? Anyway, Christian walks in with his girlfriend, and they bought the first two annual memberships. They were number one and number two, which we got a real kick out of. But we soon realized that to make the business successful, we would have to create an indoor climbing culture in Anchorage.
Yeah.
And it was years of working really hard at creating the culture, creating the awareness, and then creating the community surrounding that that we really concentrated on.
And this was 1995?
We opened August 1st of 1995.
Yeah. So no internet, right? Or very, like, where were we at in the internet age in mid-90s?
We had a rudimentary electronic check-in system, but paper paper everything.
And yeah. Were you so how did you build that community? Like word of mouth, like advertising? Like how did you make that happen?
You know, we ran around town and did slideshows at every place we could think of. Charlie was great at that. Peter Hackett was out talking it up in the ER. He was an ER physician over at what was then Humana Hospital, mm-hmm. and talking it up. And we just slowly but surely built community community awareness. I don't know, and you know, we did weird things with AM radio stations. I can remember. Sorts of yeah.
And there had to be a lot of word of mouth. I remember that era where, you know, APU, the little gym there was just a little bit chaotic. And then you guys opened, and it wasn't, which was great for us because we were an educational facility. It's our primary thing for our students and staff. And so there must have been some of that going on, like people were ready for this.
I think so. And the other aspect of it was we got going on kids programs right out of the box. And as soon as parents started realizing that it was a great activity for their children, and we had lots of kids competitions. You remember the Halloween competitions at APU. We used to bring the whole team over. It was so much fun. And so I think getting into the kid parent community was a big part of the success.
And what, let's talk a little bit about that comp history. Maybe Bruce, you can talk about a little about the history of competitions, indoor climbing competition is what we're talking about, and how that's, we started with the APUP, but tell us a little bit more about that at the gym.
Our first competition was in February of 96, and my girlfriend at the time, we were trying to come up with a name, and she said, how about the Frigid Flash? We all go, wow, that's a great name. So that has always stuck. And my brother came up to help root set for it. He was a comp root setter in Boulder. His name was Pat. And we kind of just closed the gym for one day on a Friday. The comp was going to be on a Saturday. And we stripped the entire gym. We washed all the holds. And we set 20 plus comp routes for men's elite, women's elite, and then men's open and women's open, and then some kids routes as well. And it was kind of crazy hard work. We were all up till 3 o'clock in the morning trying to get the routes finalized and safe and appropriately rated. And it finally came off pretty well the next day. And Rod Hancock from the Moose's Tooth actually won the men's competition for the first time, which he's still very proud of.
Yeah.
And I don't remember who won the women's. Sarah Westhusing?
Yeah, it was Sarah Westhusing, Bruce.
So, yeah, that was sort of the start of the comp. And we've had the comp every year, I think, except for one through 30 years. And it's still called the Frigid Flash.
And Rod is still, he's still crushing too. He took podium this past Frigid Flash that we did as well. Yeah.
You are listening to
the
last
format has changed a little bit, but obviously competitions have become a huge thing and they've really helped the indoor industry. You know, I mean, obviously they're in the Olympics and you can watch World Cup comps and all that. I mean, it's kind of crazy popular.
Yeah. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordak. We're talking about Alaska Rock Gym, otherwise known as ARG, and it's 30 years of service and building a community in Alaska. Over the years, things have changed. So even in that old facility series, like how did operations change? How did you evolve as you went?
I think probably one of the bigger things that evolved over the years was moving through into the computer age was going to everything was electronic and electronic record keeping, electronic check-in, electronic tracking of our users' skill level. You know, if they became Blaze certified, LEED certified, and that made running the business so much easier. And just being able, and some companies stepped up to provide great gym management software. And so we were able to just do more with less. So that was probably pretty key to the how the business evolved over the years. I think the other thing was just constantly, we really kept adding programs, adding kids programs, adding programs for adults, having singles night or the climbing classes for women, Rockin' Women, which still exists today on Wednesday nights, I think, at the gym. Yeah. And just always the drive to keep introducing climbing to more people and making it more accessible to more people.
Yeah.
And I have to say that there were times in the first like 5 to 6 years when I didn't think we were going to make it. Hmm. And we had we had some pretty tough conversations, but indoor climbing really began to take off in the later, like around 2005, I would say. We sort of ground along for 8 or 10 years, and then it really began to take off. And by the year 2012, 2013, we were busting at the seams.
Yeah.
So we knew we had to make a move.
I want to go back to the early years. Was that cash flow? Was it just not enough people showing in, or like why the struggles?
I think it was. It's just getting people in the door and repeating and taking climbing seriously enough that they wanted to buy a membership, and that they became, you know, part of the community, and it just took that long to become more mainstream. And also, I think people just had never seen it before. And you think about around 2010, how often on television, in films, you just started seeing climbing.
Yeah.
And so I think that we sort of rode the wave. We were lucky we started when we did. We had a tough decade, but we definitely rode the wave into this current state of indoor climbing.
Right. Well, I'm glad you made it.
Yeah, me too.
Nicole, you had an interesting comment. You said, how many gyms are there now?
I just did some industry research, and in the U.S., there's upwards of 800.
Wow. And ARG was what number?
We were number 11.
Wow.
Yeah.
Bruce, do we know what the first one was?
Typically, people say that the first gyms were in Seattle.
Yeah.
And probably someone in Seattle was the first one to invent the hold that could be moved. I mean, people had always climbed on brick structures and things like that. But what really changed it was when people started molding plastic holds and then bolting them on, because obviously then you could change the roots. And that was sort of the real change in the industry. And people say, that was first happened in France, but some people say, no, that's first happened in Seattle. So,
Seattle makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's true. The first commercial climbing gym in the United States was Seattle. Vertical World, started by Rich Johnston.
Okay. Yeah.
I think Dan Howley and the Spot Boulder were in the top five as well, I want to say.
Yeah, in Boulder.
Yeah. But that was not just Boulder.
It's a climbing hotspot, too. Yeah, I got busted climbing one of the churches downtown once in the 80s. They didn't like that a whole lot. So let's talk about climbing on buildings. Let's see. So then we get into the newer facility. So you talked about starting to burst at the seams. And so talk through that history and process of deciding to build a new facility.
Well, we had a group of very dedicated climbers at the gym who really wanted to see an expansion. And Tanya Leinecke, who's an emergency room physician over at Providence, she and her husband, Mike and Diane Moxness, were really integral in the process. And several other people just stepped up. Rod Hancock also was tired of climbing in the old gym, I think. And it took about a year and a half of development work on the project, but we located a lot in Midtown, just kitty corner from the back of the Moose's Tooth, that had everything that we needed. We could satisfy the parking requirements. That's always the problem, was, you know, a large building with, you've got to put a lot of parking spaces around them. So it checked all the boxes, and we started the design process. One of my longtime employees at the Alaska Rock Gym, Ted Phelps, which headed up our kids programs and is still the head coach for the kids programs, always had a great vision for what a more modern climbing wall should look like. You know, just how the wall should be laid out. And Ted put innumerable hours into SketchUp and creating, you know, the look of what the walls would be in the new facility. I had the vision for what it should feel like inside. You know, after all those years of being in that dark little
dusty
place, you know, my goals were to create a sun-filled, light, airy space with really good ventilation that was pristinely clean at all times, with nice locker rooms, and that was a pleasant place for our employees to spend time. I think that those were the things that I was really concentrating on.
Yeah, well, you succeeded in that. That's a great, Ted was another APU.
Yes.
So that's great to hear. And when, so what year was that? When did you?
The development went on from about the beginning of 2014. And I think we broke ground in October of 2015. And we opened our doors August 1st again of 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit. And what changes did you make? Like, what, when you went from the old facility, was that a sort of a time, I imagine, to restart a little bit and hit the reset button? So what was that reset button like? What did you do that was different and, to try to improve people's experience, maybe a little bit about safety? What did you do different?
We really worked hard at the front desk and lobby design to make bringing people into the building flow better and make more sense, because, you know, you do have to go through a process of doing some paperwork for first-time users, and we anticipated having more first-time users into the facility, mostly just because of the location. Being, you know, people waiting to have pizza at the Moose's Tooth are going to wander over to the Rock Gym.
Yeah.
And so we wanted that process to feel comfortable and natural. We also wanted people to understand what they were getting into by making a commitment to climb for the first time. In other words, you know, climbing is dangerous, and you have to assume personal responsibility when you decide to climb. And so we worked really hard at creating sort of a new communication system, which would get those ideas across to people easily, quickly, and sensibly. And again, it was a process.
Yeah. And were there problems? You talk about danger, but what, did you have issues at the gym?
No, I think our biggest problems were that just right from the first day that we opened doors there, we had a lot more people coming into the gym. Our foot traffic was higher than we ever anticipated.
Uh-huh.
And so immediately it meant hiring more staff, training more staff. And we take our, you know, our staff, they're highly trained. It takes hours of work to get a front desk person up to speed so that they're competent and able to do the job that they need to do out there. So we were faced with sort of an immediate, oh my gosh, we have to ramp this thing way up beyond what we ever imagined. So that hit us very quickly.
Excellent. You are listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Twardock. We are talking about the Alaska Rock Gym in its 30 years, and we'll be right back after this short break.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Paul Torda. We are talking about the Alaska Rock Gym, and it's 30 years in Anchorage. And I have Nicole Jolim, the general manager, Siri Moss, one of the founders and original general manager, and Bruce Adams joining us on Zoom, also one of the original founders. So we're talking at the break about the height of the wall, the height of the new gym. Talk to us about how high it is and some of the challenges that came with that, and Lola.
Well, Lola. In the design process, of course, we were going back and forth about the cost benefit of height. How high could we go? What were the costs going to be? How are we going to be managing route setting on those higher walls? And so we finally decided, yeah, we're going to build to 42 feet. It was sort of our comfort spot in the cost benefit analysis. But we soon became aware of, well, we've got a lot of wall space in this facility, and we're going to 42 feet. We need to have a lift in the building. But we were already, I think we were pouring footings. We were down the road a ways. And so we located a lift down in Seattle, Washington that we could afford that was for sale, that fit the bill for what we needed. Got it on the barge, and then the architect and the builders were like, well, where's it going to be in the building? And I was like, I don't know. So we did a really quick kind of redesign and created a barn for this lift that was coming. And that's the projection off the front of the building that is kind of an afterthought. And the lift showed up, and then we realized we were starting to frame up the steel and side the building. We realized, oh my gosh, this lift, we have to put it in the building, and it's gonna live in the building forever.
Oh,
because it's not, there is not a door big enough. It's down in the lower level pit, and that's where, and the lift soon, we named her Lola for some reason, so that became, all right, we gotta get Lola in the building, and then she's gonna live out into the future in the pit of the Alaska Rock Gym. And we actually had to go back and remove windows in that front area, and had this really dicey with the crane to get Lola into the building. And it was just like, oh my gosh, you know, you talk about trying to plan every little thing, but there's something you forget along the way. So Lola is now
Permanently there.
Lola's barn sticks out into the front, which the architects to this day, I'm sure they drive by and go, they wrecked our building.
Or I'll just turn it
now. Yeah, but the lift is integral in efficient and just good route setting. And Bruce can probably speak to that somewhat here. So
yeah, Bruce, let's talk about route setting. For those who aren't familiar, there's describe a route for us at the gym and so the process of setting routes.
Route setting is just the process of putting plastic holds on the wall in a way that people can climb from the bottom to the top via one route. Ours are color-coded. So one route would be all red holds. One route might be all blue holds. And they're different difficulties, sort of like at a ski area. We have some that are quite easy, all the way up to ones that are very, very difficult. And there's usually a little sign at the bottom that says this route is 513, which would be very, very advanced. This route is 5.8, which is sort of beginner intermediate. So people can kind of pick what they want to challenge themselves with. The routes are made with plastic holds that are bolted into the wall with a little T-nut. And it's quite extensive what we do to route set. We have 6 or 8 route setters that work basically 4 days a week full time. And of course they use the lift, but there's also a lot of manual labor. When the holds are removed, they have to be taken to the holds room and then washed, and then reorganized. Then when they're clean and dry, they have to be brought back out into the main gym to set the next route with. Our holds room is the size of a 4-car garage, And it is just lined with shelves and lined with different color holds, different size holds. Some are easy to hold on to, some are hard to hold on to. And we're continually buying holds. I think we spend, what, $70,000 a year in holds or something like that, Nicole?
Not quite that much. That's the goal. The goal is to have a real healthy, lush holds budget like that. But right now, we're not quite that high.
Nicole, how many holds do you think the gym owns right now?
I mean, number-wise, I don't know. But monetary-wise, maybe around 150,000, 200,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're expense. It's a lot of money for a couple holds. But that's just kind of the trade is... You got to keep them fresh coming in because they get worn out after a while. And then there are so many different kinds that you want to keep cycling in new, fresh stuff to just keep the people on their feet, literally.
Yeah. on their toes. All the holds are shipped up from the States as well.
Yeah.
So it's, there's certainly a charge to ship them.
Yeah. And ropes too, right? You're out on the call for this year. Now, what's the turnover on ropes and how does that work?
It's a little more use dependent with ropes. We obviously do safety checks regularly on them. The unfortunate part of gym climbing is when people borrow our ropes, especially for lead climbing, it's like a rental car. Like, oh, I can beat the heck out of it. And so sometimes we see higher wear and tear for our lead ropes. But our top ropes, again, it has to do with use. But we check them regularly, and it's still a hefty cost to the gym to replace them. But we make sure that it's in the budget, and we keep everyone as safe as possible when it comes to our ropes.
Nicole, let's go to you. You're managing it now.
Yeah.
And so when you walked in this new job, and you came from the lower 48, correct? When you looked around, what was your first impression?
One of the things that drew me to this job was, as Siri kind of mentioned earlier, the vibe and the look and the feel that she wanted in this gym was very reflective of the last gym I managed. And I really loved that last gym. I left on very good terms. The only reason I left is because Siri was retiring and I wanted her job. And and that was the next career stepping stone for me. And so when I walked in, I did feel very much like this homey vibe of like, yes, this big, clean, modern facility makes me feel better about moving across the world.
partly. Yeah. And what was your sort of learning curve coming into it?
One of my biggest learning curves was coming from managing gyms in a highly competitive market to Anchorage, Alaska, and we're the only gym. The next closest gym is 6 hours away. And that was a learning curve for me personally, just on how I know how to do things. Like, okay, I'm used to always having to be like, what's the competition doing? To hear, like, there really is no competition. However, the end goal is the same, as what's going to bring the user into the gym, and how do I make a connection there, and how do I breed those relationships and foster community? That hasn't changed, whether I'm in Colorado or I'm in Alaska. But it was definitely a learning curve for me to be like, oh, there's no competitive market.
Well, so
here,
I'm gonna push on that a little bit.
Yeah.
Like you said, there's no competition, but people have choices. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at both of you and Siri, like, because people can go to other gyms and they can do other things, right? And out here we have skiing, we have a plethora of activities people can do. Mm-hmm. So how's that play into your thinking as you manage?
Yeah, I have learned that even if you have a primary sport, normally people have a secondary sport, especially when your sport is seasonal. Yeah. And so most climbers by default are also skiers or snowboarders, or they are bikers. They might have other things, but those are usually the top three competing sports. But something that's really important to me, and I think a lot of new gyms are certainly picking up on this as well, but climbing and fitness go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. It's not, oh, I just climb and then someone's at your local, you know, weight gym and I just do cardio and weights and that. They go hand in hand and they both help the other. And so we have been really leaning into drawing that connection there. And so we did it was called River Ready Fitness, and it was just an 8-week series. You didn't have to take all eight days. It was one day a week. You could drop in whenever, but it was at the beginning of kind of water season this summer. And we're like, hey, if you want to get ready to be rafting and kayaking and on the water, we have this River Ready Fitness. And it was popping. Huh. We are definitely going to have to do that again next year.
So nothing to do with climbing, really.
Yeah, nothing to do with climbing. Yeah, yeah. Yep. And then same thing, right now we have some ski fit classes happening, which 'tis the season, like your legs better be ready, because if they're not, you're going to be limping. Yeah. but yeah, to really foster, like, this can be a place for you, even if you're not a climber. And part of that does go into the feel of the gym when you get there. We have a beautiful yoga and fitness annex that people can get a membership to that only if they don't want to go to a regular weights gym and potentially feel intimidated by the vibes you usually get from there. But it's like, hey, you can still be a part of our community and you don't have to be a climber.
I'm interested, and maybe this is a look at a new series, the yoga connection. Like, I can sort of see yoga and climbing, but like, really, like, how'd that come about?
Oh, yoga, climbers do yoga. I mean, that was very clear to me from early on.
Yeah.
And that was something that just drove me crazy about our old facility, is we were having yoga classes up in that little corner up in, you know, next to where we had our little fitness area, and there'd be like 12 people trying to do sun salutes or whatever, and I was so determined to have a space where we could actually have real yoga classes that would serve the yoga community, but would be serving our climbing community, because climbers love to stretch out. They all have sore shoulders. They all have sore elbows.
There's a level of flexibility needed, though. The higher route, like, grades that you climb, there are just certain times when you have to have some level of flexibility.
That's absolutely right.
And so yoga goes hand in hand
yoga
with it.
yoga has to be right there. So,
well, I agree, but
I think, is it Margo Hayes is the iconic female athlete who's known for, like, throwing her heel above her head.
Yeah, right.
And I bet she takes yoga.
Bruce, let's go back to you for a second. I'm skipping on here a little bit, but I am interested in, we talk about yoga and skiing and boating. What is the relationship with indoor climbing and outdoor climbing? Like, this is an outdoor show, and we're talking about an indoor sport. So talk a bit about that, that interaction between outdoor and indoor climbing.
Alaska is a little bit unique in that there is not a lot of easily accessible outdoor rock climbing. So I think a lot of the people that climb and train in the gym regularly will plan a climbing trip at least once or twice a year. You know, maybe they go to Las Vegas in the fall, maybe they go to Colorado or Kentucky in the spring, but there are a lot of travelers in our little climbing community. Of course, there are people that only climb indoors. It is a legitimate sport to never climb outdoors. So that's sort of a new thing in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, but it's certainly legitimate. I mean, I'm sure some of our kids who are in the kids program who are quite good at indoor climbing have probably never climbed outdoors or only a few times in their life. And you know, maybe they get super interested in it and they go off to college somewhere where there's climbing. But maybe, you know, indoor climbing is the end goal for them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly good training. All top climbers train a fair amount indoors, because it's just basically impossible to climb outdoors all the time due to logistics and weather and partners. And you can go to the gym. No matter how much it's snowing outside, you can go to the gym without a climbing partner and get a workout. So it certainly is convenient.
Yeah, and so we were talking a little earlier, but it's not outdoor climbing, right?
Right.
It's not outdoor climbing.
Right.
Right. It's not exactly transferable, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, we teach a very specific skill set in the indoor gym, which relates to indoor gym climbing. And while those skills certainly translate to the outdoors, it's not the outdoor climbing requires a broader spectrum of knowledge and skill. So, you know, but indoor climbing, I mean, just look at the fact that, like as Nicole said, it's an Olympic sport now, and you see it everywhere. And so there are many people. I'd be interested, Nicole, some time to know how many of our current climbing members only climb in the indoor gym. Mm-hmm.
You know? That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Paul Tordock, and we are talking about Alaska Rock Gym in their 30 years. Nicole, let's go to sort of future trends. And like, what's the future look like? You're the future.
Thank you.
No pressure.
Okay, well, specific to the gym and maybe just gyms in general. So again, I've managed two gyms down in the Colorado Front Range prior to my experience here in Alaska. And being down there, again, it was a little different. Lots of competition, lots of climbers, lots of outside climbing access, just a different mentality. But the climbing industry as a whole is constantly changing. You know, the way that we learned how to use certain belay devices back in the day are now used completely different. What we know as a lot of just standards of belaying, there's a lot of different ways to belay. There might be one right way that has has more risk mitigation with it than others. And it's the industry is constantly adapting. Part of that is technology. And so one of the bigger pushes that I'm seeing in the industry right now is adding systems boards, which are boards. They're small bouldering walls that move. You can adjust the angle. And then there's an app that you link to that you can light up the climb. And so it's very friendly to everybody. You can have it straight up at 0 degrees and do a very beginner climb on it. You can have it straight up at 0 degrees and do a very advanced climb on it. But then you can adjust the angle and the wall mechanically moves down. And so it can go from very beginner friendly to very advanced very quickly. And they're kind of this hot commodity that's happening. There's gyms opening up that only feature these boards. But we just installed a 16-foot Kilter board last year, which was very exciting that we got to kind of be on par with that trend. And people love it. We just hosted our first little, we called it the Little Kilter Comp. And we had everywhere from brand new beginners to our head and assistant route setter join this Little Kilter Comp. And it was so much fun for everybody. And so things like that, just being open to new technologies that are coming out. We're also sampling one of the many climbing apps where people can, our setters upload what routes are currently on the wall, what grade they're at, and the user can log into the app and say, yes, I climbed it, I liked it, or I didn't like it, and they can track their own progress. Uh-huh. And so we are currently demoing one of those apps right now. We'll probably launch that to our members here shortly. You don't have to do it, but I mean, if you're a person like me and you want to track your fitness and see that growth, they're really cool to use.
I want to go back to one thing. Yeah. So people aren't familiar with bouldering. We haven't talked about the bouldering area, but there's a whole, describe that. There's a whole bouldering area upstairs. There's the rope climbing and then there's bouldering. So just briefly talk about that area.
Yeah, bouldering is climbing without ropes. So every fall is a ground fall. If you let go, you're hitting the ground. I think most bouldering areas go up to about 14 feet, which is where our bouldering, the top height you're ever going to get is 14 feet. The pads are usually much squishier than what you get in roped areas because they've just got to protect your ankles from that height of fall. And it's a lot easier to, as Bruce kind of mentioned earlier, go to the gym without a belay partner, get your workout in because you can boulder, versus rope climbing, you're always on a rope and there's always some secondary level of being attached to something. Whereas again, bouldering, it's the biggest thing we teach. Every fall is a ground fall.
And so we have Kilter boards. Anything else that's on the horizon for us?
Not quite on the horizon right now. I think the biggest thing that we're doing right now is adding some more fitness room and fitness elements to our gym to, again, just kind of bridge that gap between fitness as a part of climbing. Yeah. And so hopefully we'll be getting some new machines in here, but nothing climbing related quite right now.
So you mentioned the word crown fall. Mm-hmm. I'm like, whoop. Talk about risk management.
Ooh, okay, risk management. Yeah, the climbing industry is dangerous, period. It is dangerous. And what's been really interesting for me to be in this industry for the last 10 years, and it's been fun and also terrifying to manage, is we're introducing the general public to something that is extremely high risk. It's kind of like if I were to say skydiving is for everybody, and there are many people and listeners who are cringing, like, not for me, because it's dangerous and it doesn't appeal to everybody. But climbing is just that too. I'm like, hey, here's this dangerous sport, and we're making it accessible to a lot more people. But by doing so, we also have to make sure that that risk mitigation is also something that we're making abundantly clear to them, that there is a level of personal accountability, but there is also a level that what do we do as gym operators to make sure that everybody walking into our facility knows that this is dangerous and we're going to give you the tools and resources to mitigate as much risk as possible and to have fun. But first and foremost, always has to be safety. And what can we do to keep this a fun environment that is hopefully injury free? And again, we want to expose people to new things. But
and what do you think is the key to that?
I think the key to that, in my professional opinion, is very clear policies and staying up to date on what the professionals are telling us. And then explaining that to the user. We often have to explain things that I call it the duh factor, just personally, but I'm like, well, duh, like don't climb under anybody because if they fall, they have a boulder fall, right? Every fall is a ground fall. If you are the person falling, you can't control where you fall, but a person running underneath you has control on where they can run underneath you. And so the biggest part of us communicating that to people is our staff. And our staff do, first and foremost, they have people sign their liability waivers, but then we give them a very thorough gym orientation of, hey, here's all the things that you need to know. We offer entry level classes if you want to start belaying. And this is pretty common with most gyms, but we're trying to give the general person, the general public, this very clear idea of there's a lot of risk involved here, but here's how we can have fun doing it. But yeah, staff training opportunities for staff, but also for the public are huge. And the risk mitigation is always the top topic of conversation. It's never, well, how can people have more fun with less risk? Like that just doesn't happen. It's how can we continue to mitigate risk while people also have fun?
And in the gym, what's that progression? Like if I walk in and I'm a beginner or think I know something, whether I may or may not, what's my progression in the gym? You mentioned classes. Are there classes I can take? How do I get into the sport?
Yeah. I would say, one, just come in and watch people and be like, whoa, that looked so scary and that was appealing to me. I want to learn more. Or like, whoa, that looked so scary. I don't want to take a big whip in the cave. I would rather just boulder and take a ground fall. So just come in. We have meetup groups where it's a casual climbers meetup every Thursday. Anyone can join, and it's fun to just make friends that way. As we mentioned earlier, too, we have Rock and Women's Group, which is just a femme or ally to females meetup group. But then technical training classes, we always offer, we do a bouldering technique class. And so that's truly a climbing technique class. It's for the noobs and the non-noobs to just learn, hey, this is how we move our body on the wall where it's going to be the most effective.
Nice.
And then as far as the rope skills, we offer top rope belay classes, which is going to be kind of step one, is learn how to top rope belay. Top rope belay is when the rope is already on the wall, it's attached to an anchor at the top. And I think of it as you are climbing to the top of the rope, and then the belayer lowers you down. After you're comfortable with that, the next progression would be to learn how to lead climb. And I think of that as you're leading the rope up the wall. And so that's when you see people in the movies or on YouTube taking those big whips. And there's still ways that we can mitigate risk with those things. And I'm hoping to introduce a class here in the next couple months about falling techniques. And so that's kind of the next step is you lead belay someone and you're comfortable with that. But then how do you lead belay them if there's some weird terrain under you, if you're over a ledge or if you're over a volume, which is a feature that would jut out from the wall? And there's different ways to belay and to catch people around those elements as well. And so it is very progressional on how we teach people so that we're not overloading them, but we're preparing them for, hey, this is the next step.
Yeah, and all those classes are very accessible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're scheduled, there's several a week.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to sign up online. And so anyone with the slightest bit of interest that thinks, oh, that's something I want to try, the path is pretty easy to follow, and it's so much fun.
We're getting toward the end here. One of the topics we mentioned at the break was community, and you mentioned community, mm-hmm. Nicole. Talk about that a minute and what you've done to, and what your ideas for a building community and outreach.
Of course, this is one of my favorite things to talk about, and I've carried it through every climbing gym I've worked at, but in my own personal life too. I enjoy spending time with the people who are close to me and to strengthening those relationships. It's been a lot of fun to come up to Alaska and continue to grow the community that is already here. And I've come to learn that Anchorage and Alaskans are very protective of their community, and they're very much like, this is the way that Alaskans do it, and you don't question it. And I'm like, ah, but I have a question.
Good for you.
Yeah. And so I have learned in the climbing industry, a lot of gyms say the word community somewhere on their website. And I've had these conversations where I'm like, well, what do you do for the community? And unfortunately, the answer I often get back is, well, we are just a hub for where people can come hang out. And that never resonated with me. I like to give back to the community. And so at Alaska Rock Gym, it's been a lot of fun to start doing that in very real, very big ways. And so we work with, when we do our lost and found sales, we don't pocket any of that money. We sell all the goods for dirt cheap. And usually it's like people that have left stuff with us for 3+ months. And I'm like, okay, well, this jacket isn't being claimed. I'm going to sell it for $2. Yeah. All of that money we donate to local organizations. We also started doing First Fridays, and we'll have local artists and people from the community come in. And we just give them a free place to market their goods. They can sell something. They can talk to people. And again, it's really fun to see them come back. And then to see them build on those relationships. We do a lot of things where we bring in vendors, work with other local businesses like the Moose's Tooth, and just try to strengthen those bonds and let people know what's going on in Anchorage, not just at the Alaska Rock Gym.
That's fantastic. We're about done. I just want to pose one last question, and I'll start with Siri. What are you most proud of with this gym?
Yeah. Well, I would say that looking back over 30 years, one of the really cool things about the gym has been the multi-generational aspect of folks who started climbing at the gym back in the late 90s when we first started, got their kids in kids programs, their kids competed or, you know, were part of the youth climbing community at the gym for some years. And now those kids, their kids, are in our youth climbing programs at the gym. And I think that's really cool to look around and go, wow, two generations of little Alaskan rugrats have worked their way through learning how to climb indoors and know the joy of just climbing. I think about the number of weddings we've had at the gym over the years, people who've met at the gym and formed their long-term relationships. So I guess it's just that we've provided this forum, this venue, this place where people have been coming together for many years now.
Well, congratulations. And congratulations for an excellent 30 years into the next 30 years.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Outdoor Explorer, and this is Paul Twyford, your host.
Thanks to my guests Siri Moss, Bruce Adams, and Nicole Jolin. I'm all the hosts at Outdoor Explorer. Climb on, and we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.